For the week of August 30th, 2015, this is Showbiz Sandbox, episode 292, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in Birmingham, Alabama, I'm Michael Giltz.
You're still in Birmingham.
I'm still in Birmingham. I'll be going back to New York in mid-September for the New York Film Festival. The screenings start in September 14th, and then the movies kick out for the public towards the end of the month.
Well, remind me that I have to actually speak with you about some of these Broadway shows that I have to get tickets for.
You got Hamilton. You're all right. Don't worry about it.
Okay. All right. Fine. But
when you come to New York?
I'm coming to New York in September, the end of September.
You're keeping it vague. All right.
September 24th, I think. I can't remember the exact date. But hey, if you're in New York and maybe want to get together, hey, email us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can also call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND or 7263. Okay?
I don't really want to speed date our listeners. Is that what you're trying to do? What are you doing here?
No, I don't know. I figured, you know, a little meetup, trying to use all the lingo that the tech folks use these days.
Cool. Networking.
Yes, that thing right. too. We'll do that thing. But you know, actually, Michael, if our listeners happen to be subscribed to our show on iTunes, hey, please rate and review the show on any one of those podcast aggregators where you find the show. It does help us out.
It certainly does. And of course, if they're rating this week's show, what will we be talking about that they will review?
Well, that's the best part, you know, because I mentioned if you're in New York, but a lot of our listeners are all over the world. And because of that, get your passport ready, Michael, because on this week's show, we're going to be taking a bit of a world tour. Our first stop is in Russia, where last week a court sentenced Ukrainian director Oleg Sentsov to 20 years in prison on what some in the international film community are calling trumped up terror charges.
No, everybody is calling it Trump. No, that's not some people are. No, it is trumped up charges. There's no two ways about it.
Look, that's, I don't want to.
There's not a debate about that.
I don't want to get in trouble with the Russian folks, okay?
Well, don't travel there and you'll be all right.
All right, fine. Then maybe I shouldn't travel to Bangladesh either, where we're headed next, because the government there has banned a film depicting the exploitative conditions in the country's garment industry. And after Bangladesh, we're going to be headed over to China, where Warner Brothers is planning to launch a joint venture allowing the studio to make local language movies. Here in the United States, it seems the only thing Michael and I have to worry about when it comes to entertainment is having so much television to watch that it's become difficult, if not impossible, to find the good shows. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover all the big entertainment headlines from the past week. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
That's right, and we're talking about box office around the world. We get our info from RentTrack. You'll find a link to their website in our show notes. And also, of course, Variety, Hollywood Reporter, The LA Times, Box Office Profits, Box Office Mojo, you name it. And the number one movie around the world turning from a flop to a hit is Terminator Genesis. It made $24 million over the weekend. Thank you, China. It's now at $409 million worldwide. It cost about $150 million to make, which clearly does not reflect all the money Arnie gets. Nonetheless, it's about to triple its budget, finally, with one last big market to go, which is China. It's getting there, and it's going to do that, and so they won't lose their shirt. It's not going to be a big success story, but certainly this is a movie that domestically in North America made $90 million and was a disaster. And number two around the world is Mission Impossible Rogue Nation. Tom Cruise is a consistent world star, but he's never had a huge franchise. He's never been in the billion-dollar range or 809. You know, he's not up there. So Mission Impossible made $23 million over the weekend. It's at $470 million worldwide, and that's really good for him. It's going to be the second highest grossing Mission Impossible film of all time. So this is his baby. This is his puppy, and it's another solid delivery. Again, it's not out of the park crazy for a movie that costs $150 million, but it's a solid success story.
And it's both his baby, his child, and his pet, his puppy.
Okay.
And number you said three, it, not me. I'm quoting what you just said. It's his baby, it's his puppy.
And number three is Straight Outta Compton. Another $20 million. It's at $140 million worldwide. It's starting to open up overseas. It's in eight other territories, and it made about $7 million internationally. Here in North America, it's been the number one movie for 3 weeks in a row.
I think so, yes.
The dog days of August. There's not a lot of competition, but it's still a great success story. This is one of the highest grossing music-based films of all time in North America, obviously. What are you going to say, Sperling?
Well, wait a second. La Bamba, okay, counting for inflation.
La Bamba made good money, but yes, we're not accounting for inflation. The Sound of Music was the biggest movie worldwide of all time in its day. Grease was a monster in the late 70s. There are a lot of movies that have made money. And if you count animated films, as those, well, they are musicals. So if you count them, then you're looking at some movies like Frozen and The Lion King that all top Straight Outta Compton. But this is a massive success story. It's perhaps going to pass Chicago here in North America. It could do that, may not. But Chicago is like 170, 180 million in North America. That's the highest grossing movie of all time for a live action music based film. So, you know, this is a really big success. It's starting to open overseas. It'll be fun to see where it ends up. And I can't believe they still have announced The Sugar Hill Gang as a movie.
Well, you know, and the next film on the chart is Minions, which hit $1 billion at the worldwide box office this week.
Right. No singing.
That's right. And it's now the third highest grossing animated film of all time.
Well, we talked about that last week. Yeah,
oh, we covered did?
That. Yes, we did. I mentioned that. And you said, well, yeah, we mentioned it's right behind Frozen and Toy Story 3. We said it was going to pass it and thus become.
Oh, so we were predicting it.
We're ahead of everybody else.
Okay.
Probably.
Okay.
If you wait for them to tell you, you're going to be in the dark. If you come to us, you're going to know it first.
Okay.
At number five around the world is Hitman, Agent 47, another $16 million. That's at $36 million worldwide. Here's a new movie for us. Of course, it's in China. It's The 100 Regiments Offensive. This is a Chinese war movie. It's about an action, I think, in 1940, in which the Communist Party troops, there were different troops with different leaders in China, fighting off the Japanese occupation and invasion of parts of China. This is a famous and, in fact, controversial battle. It's not just a straightforward, oh, look at this great victory from the past. This is actually a touchstone in the Cultural Revolution. The man who led this offensive fell out of favor, and now he's sort of back in, and he's out of favor again. So how you talk about this battle is actually, it's pretty touching, interesting. I'd love to know what the movie's take on it is and why it's playing well and what that means as far as the country and the attitudes towards it and the history and Peng, who was on the outs because Mao said you didn't really ask for permission and he was shunned and, you know, shamed during the Cultural Revolution. So this is a complicated, interesting movie. And I couldn't tell from the reviews and the YouTube stuff what was going on here. So maybe they just play it straight. Maybe it's just a happy triumph over Japan. But if anybody knows, let us know exactly what's going on here. And is this movie treading dangerous ground? Does it reflect some loosening of standards or loosening of talk about this issue or reflect what's going on in China today? You know, these are the sort of things that are sort of interesting, you know, when you get a glimpse into a country about what movies are popular.
Well, and if you need to write to us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com, you can do that.
That's right. Another big movie in China is The Dead End. This is a Chinese drama. It grossed $14 million over the weekend. I guess it opened on Wednesday because it's at $18 million and counting. It's a crime movie of sorts. It's about the brutal murder of a family. It's based on a true story, I think. And there was a long battle for justice denied. The killers got away with it, but then eventually justice triumphed. And it was a success story at the Shanghai Film Festival. It won Best Director and Best Actor there. So it's a critically acclaimed film as well as a popular success. Moving on a little bit down below, we have Inside Out still chugging along, $715 million worldwide. And then the big news here in North America, it's War Room. This movie grossed $11 million over the weekend. Frankly, it only cost $3 million to make. It's a faith-based movie by the Kendricks brothers. And it only cost $3 million to make. That's what it made on opening day on Friday. So this has been a success from day one.
I want to know, who in this film plays James Carville?
It's not The War Room. It's not a fictional remake of the Bill Clinton documentary. And multiple people have asked me that, actually. But it is a faith-based movie. A war room, in this case, do you have a war room in your house, Sperling? It's like a closet or a small space where you go in to pray and fight Satan and, you know, resolve your faith. And it's sort of a place to focus your thoughts and energies and say, I'm going to go into the war room and I'm going to focus on my faith and pray. And a woman in this movie who has a troubled marriage goes into her war room and starts to turn her life around and her husband's life around. Sort of interesting on a couple levels. One, it's the latest faith-based movie to be a success story. When you got an underserved group and you make a movie for them, they're going to come to it.
Yeah.
Two, it's mostly, it's a black film. It's a film with black stars, even though the men who made it are white. And they decided for some reason that it should have a black cast. So it's a rare film that's not Tyler Perry Presents, I think, as Box Office Prophets put it, that has a black cast and is talking about faith in the box office. So that's sort of interesting that they would do that. And it's working for both white and black Christian audiences.
My war room is called The Studio.
The one, is that where you're in right now?
Yes.
Oh, very cool. I just picture you like out on your terrace or something. Your veranda. Yes. No?
No.
The one other thing about this movie is that one audience it's not working for are critics.
Ah, okay.
Most critics didn't go see it. And I don't know whether that's because it wasn't made available to them. Maybe they didn't even bother trying to get, you know, mainstream critics to go because they know it's not for them. But even Christian critics that reviewed it didn't have very good things to say. One outlet is called Influx, and it's a pretty very popular Christian site that covers all sorts of, I think, pop culture from a Christian perspective. And the guy there said, this film is so bad and contemptible that it would make Jesus himself take his father's name in vain. So it wasn't a rave. So, but you know, it's a commercial success. It's interesting. It's, you know, not every movie works that's faith-based. We're beyond that stage where just because you've made a movie, they'll come out for it, because every group has that period where, you know, you make something about them, they're going to show up. They're not there anymore. So there have been some flops in the faith-based category this year, but this is definitely a success story.
Well, I guess the next couple films on the list here, Man from U.N.C.L.E. at number 10, earning another $9.9 million worldwide. Ted 2, another $9.3 million worldwide. I guess both of those, I mean, Ted 2, is it a success? It's made $190 million worldwide. I don't know. I think Universal
was
hoping.
It cost about $70 million to make. It's okay. About to triple its budget, so it will get there. You know, it's not like I don't think Mark Wahlberg is going to have a big piece of the back end. So, again, this is more like a classic sequel. You know, Ted made a ton of money. There was no natural sequel there, but they made one anyway. And like in the old days, it made about a third of what the original did, you know, or half. You know, that's just what happens with sequels when they're not one long continuing story. That's how it used to be. So they made it for a price. They're going to make their money, and they squeezed out a couple extra dollars and another film to add to their franchise library. And, you know. Well, I think they'll all be happy. Of course, they would have loved it more if it made $800 million and there was a Ted 3, but that ain't going to happen.
Well, you know, Seth MacFarlane, he's really into that big band jazz sound, you know, that kind of like old-time sound. Well, congratulations, he now has, you know, old-time sequels too, you know?
That's right. Here in North America, another movie opened up. It's called No Escape with Owen Wilson and Pierce Brosnan. It opened pretty weakly, about $8 million over the weekend. It's at $10 million and counting. But what I thought notable was that it cost $5 million to make. Pierce Brosnan and Owen Wilson in a drama that cost $5 million. Has their quote gone down?
No,
this
but
isn't
I
labor
mean,
of love, is it?
Well,
I mean, it's just a movie.
I'm going to check, but I think maybe one of them produced it.
Ah, well, that would make sense.
And Pierce Brosnan is kind of known for doing films on that level when he's the producer.
So there's a bunch of other movies on this list. When you're looking worldwide and you're including every film that grossed about $3 million or more, you're going to come up with 27 films on your chart. Down towards the bottom is the last film worth talking about this week. That is We Are Your Friends. It's a Zac Efron film about the DJ scene. It cost $6 million to make. It opened to $3.4 million worldwide because it did open in about 12 territories. It is notable as the biggest wide release bomb from Hollywood in history.
Yeah, that's pretty remarkable, actually.
Independent films have grossed lower, but for a movie opening on 2,000 screens from a studio, this is it, baby. This is the worst opening of all time. So, well done. But, you know, I had a joke there about, oh, Zac Efron should start looking at TV. But you know what? He's going to be fine. He had Neighbors was a big hit. He's got some good properties coming up ahead. So, like you say, every movie star has bombs. What happens is, can you make people come out to your next movie? You know, he's not a movie star yet, of course. He's not a draw, but he has made some movies that have made money. He's a name, and, you know, he'll be just fine.
Well, and to fill in the gap here, it looks like Pierce Brosnan and Owen Wilson, neither of them are listed as producers on No Escape. So I don't know why they did a film at that cost.
I think maybe they're just not that much in demand at the moment.
Maybe. I don't know.
It's just sort of a routine film. They decided to make it. Hasn't worked out. Oh, well. They're both fine actors, of course.
Yes.
And opening up this week here in North America and perhaps around the world are two movies from big studios. One is Transporter Refueled. That's a reboot without Jason Statham. I don't think anybody cares about that. And the other one is A Walk in the Woods, based on the very popular Bill Bryson book. And it's being brought to life with Robert Redford, Nick Nolte, and Emma Thompson. Parents everywhere will be flocking to that film.
Really?
Well, I'm just saying it's an adult movie.
Okay.
I'm just saying it's for adults.
Okay.
And, you know, if it's any good, it will have legs.
It did not get very good reviews out of Sundance, that's for sure.
Oh, it didn't? Oh, no. Well, so that will have a rough time. Is it commercial?
I did not see it, so I don't know.
All right. Well, you know, movies, you know, we talked about some of the movies up above and what makes money worldwide. But when you play in the worldwide market, it can get dangerous, can it?
Yes. And I don't exactly know what you're referring to. We've already talked about Minions. But maybe you're referring to if you make a movie that some government doesn't like, then you could be, I don't know, thrown in jail.
Or just you become outspoken because you're a public figure.
Yeah.
And you speak out. And that's what happened to Ukrainian director Oleg Sentsov. What's going on there?
I guess he threatened an official
said he was going to... No, that's what the lie that they're spreading.
Well,
he
didn't
set any office on fire. He didn't threaten anybody. That's just total BS. Russia invaded Ukraine. He said, I don't like that. And they've thrown him into jail.
Correct. Yes.
And they've tried him as a Russian. When he's not Russian, he's Ukrainian.
Right.
And they sentenced him to 20 years in prison on trumped up charges. And to their credit, you know, the European Film Academy has spoken out. Finally, after a bit of silence, some major Russian directors have spoken out, including the director of the Oscar-nominated film Leviathan. He spoke out. He's their big director right now. So that's taking a bold step for him. We say, oh, gee, you people should speak out. But in fact, you know, they're taking a risk.
You know, you say that it's Leviathan, but I don't know. Did he actually direct Leviathan? Alexander Sokurov?
He didn't direct Leviathan. He's another director.
Okay.
No,
okay.
Sokurov did the Russian Ark. No, it's what's his name? I just didn't know how to pronounce his name, so I didn't include it.
Yeah, I actually sat next to him on a plane, and we tried to have a conversation.
Who?
Alexander Sokurov.
Okay, so you're confusing me. We have multiple Russian directors have come forward. The director of Leviathan, which was just nominated for an Oscar, and he's their golden boy right now. He's
That's right.
Terrific director. How do you say his name? Look it up while I talk. But he came out and said that this was wrong. I think he said, was it him or Sokurov who said it makes him ashamed to be Russian?
I think Sokurov said that.
Sokurov, who of course directed Russian Ark and a string of movies about powerful world figures like Stalin and
Lenin,
Japanese emperor and Hitler. He spoke out and said it was wrong. One person we haven't heard from is Russian nationalist Nikita Mikhailov. So far he's been silent because he probably agrees with it. I shouldn't say that. For all I know, he has spoken out, or maybe he's applauded it. If anybody knows, again, let us know.
Well, and the director you're referring to, the director of Leviathan, is Andrei Zvigenstev.
Yeah, that's that last name that screws me up. He's a terrific director. When I see his name, I want to see his movies. I just don't want to pronounce them. But that's not where Russia stopped here. This is a big news for Russia and film this week, right? They're really clamping down on dissent, aren't they?
Yeah, and how did that work out with Pussy Riot? I mean, nobody heard about Pussy Riot before they decided to lock him up for 2 years. And now, of course, Pussy Riot's
No, it's not true that if you clamp down on dissent, the people will always flourish and get worldwide attention and you will suffer.
I know. I'm just saying, yeah. You know, how's that working out for Russia? Moscow premiere. Okay, it sounds like you're premiering Moscow, but actually Moscow Premiere is a very successful film festival. It's been around for 13 years. They made free tickets available to senior citizens, and it was mainly kind of a social kind of event. Right.
They weren't breaking big movies like Telluride or, you know, Cannes, obviously. But,
no.
You know, they've been around for 12 years. They had their new festival was just starting like a couple weeks or a week or two, and suddenly they said, oh, by the way, we're not funding it, and it's going to go away.
Right. And the Moscow City Council said, you know that money that we usually give you? We're not going to give it to you. By the way, you are liberal, right? Yeah. So we're definitely not giving it to you. Away it went.
Yeah. It's not really a political festival as such, though obviously the organizers have screened movies like one about neo-Nazis in Russia and another one that portrayed gay people in a positive light, gay Russian citizens. So apparently they ruffled some feathers, and now the government said no to yet to this festival and yes to another festival, which will be overseen by a member of what's that group called? United Russia, which is a right-wing political organization, and the guys who are in power right now, you know, patsies of Putin. So they get their festival, this one goes away, and everybody loses.
You've got a million of them today. You know, his baby, his puppy, Putin's patsies.
It's a lot of alliteration from nervous newscasters.
Yes.
And people are nervous in Bangladesh about a new movie as well, aren't they?
Yeah, and I can't remember the name of the movie, but it is a film that actually depicts...
It's Rana Plaza.
Rana Plaza.
It's okay. The name of the girl, I believe, or maybe that's the name of
the building. Factory that collapsed. You might recall that a factory collapsed. It killed more than 1,000 people. To put that in perspective, 3,000 people died on September 11th in the World Trade Center. So you've got, or I think the World Trade Center and the Pentagon combined. So in that case, it was
an attack. And in this case, it was incompetence and indifference to your employees. They had a building that they built with, you know, complete disregard for safety. They added on extra floors that were not approved. And so, of course, the thing pancaked and crushed and killed a lot of people wholly unnecessarily.
Right. And as it is in Bangladesh, the garment industry is, exploitative to begin with. Mostly, poorer and rural workers working in those factories, many of them underage, many of them under the age of 13, in fact.
Which is the person that this movie focuses on, isn't it? It's a young teenage girl.
Yes. And she survived 17 days in the rubble of this factory. And that's why they focused the story around her. And you'd think it would be inspiring, maybe uplifting, very enlightening. And Bangladesh said, yeah, it's all of those things. It's also not going to be seen.
Yeah, so, please don't remind people of how we don't care about our factory workers and we crushed a lot of them.
Yes.
They said, just cut out the stuff where you show all the horror and devastation.
The part right there at the beginning, cut from there right up to the part where it says the end. Cut those parts.
They've banned the movie for 6 months and the courts have said, is there any reason why this movie shouldn't be banned forever?
Right.
And,
like, why just 6 months?
They've sent it back and said, yeah, I don't think so. So we'll see what happens. But clearly they're afraid of the movie. It will shine a light again, however good or bad, is on the fact that there are, you know, human rights violations and shocking conditions in the factories of Bangladesh.
Well, and you kind of have to wonder if that's happening in Bangladesh and a country that is kind of a freckle compared to the size of China.
Freckle. It's a $23 billion business for Bangladesh, the garment business. It's one of the main drivers of their economy. So it's hugely important to them, and that's why they're not messing around.
Right, but I guess population-wise, what is the population of Bangladesh?
Compared to China?
Yeah. It's 156 million people in Bangladesh compared to China at 1.4 billion. Mm-hmm. It's good that we're hearing about this kinds of censorship in a country that is, half the size of the U.S. I don't even know, one-tenth the size of
Well, it's a country China. Where you can perhaps have some outside influence and people can shine a light on it. When it's somebody like China, it's a lot harder to influence them or, shake your finger at them if they do something wrong. There's obviously lots of pollution and working problems in China. But why are we talking about China? It's obviously a big market for Hollywood. And who's moving in there?
Well, it looks like Warner Brothers, both brothers are actually, and maybe all three. I don't know
keep
how many
going,
brothers. They're going to actually move to China. Apparently, or at least they're going to kind of form a joint venture there so that they can produce movies in local language Mandarin.
Now, yeah, this is not about Hollywood filming a Hollywood movie in China.
No.
Like they do all over the world. This is about them investing and going to China to make Mandarin language films for a Chinese audience.
That's right. They're basically making product that will be appreciated in a local market.
Now, Hollywood does this all over the world, right?
Well,
they go to France and they like to be players in every market. They want to make some French films. They want to make, don't they do this everywhere?
Not so much. Not as much as you might think. What they'd rather do is pick a film up if it's worthwhile. And what they do, however, is they do it in India. Disney's been doing a lot in India. Sony's been doing a lot in India, but not as much locally. You know, sometimes, yes, they'll do one-offs, two-offs. They're getting more into it, that is for sure. The trend is more toward producing local language content or indigenous content in each of these markets.
Just like Netflix is doing.
Right. However, it hasn't been like, oh, let's produce 10, 12 movies a year in France. No, it's like, okay, we produced one movie over the last 3 years or two movies this year. You know, it's... mostly in India, they've been doing this.
In India, they've been picking stuff up, or they've been funding local. They've stepped in and said, "We're making movies here,"
right?
And they hired directors. So it's not that they're saying, "Oh, we like the movie you're making. We'll do half the budget." They're stepping in and they're making projects happen. They're hiring directors. They're funding the movie. It's soup to nuts.
Correct. Yes.
Okay. And that's what Warner Brothers is doing in China.
Yeah. Well, that's what they'd like to do in China. Yes.
Well, that's what they're planning to do, right?
Yes.
Or is there some block to them?
No, I think, you always have to look.
They're in talks with China Media Capital, a state-backed investment fund that's focused on the entertainment industry to form a joint venture that would make local language films. So, I mean, it hasn't, the ink is not dry. It hasn't happened. There are always roadblocks, but that's their plan.
That is their plan. And of course, you know, you always have those questions of the state can come in China and kind of pull some, you know, kind of flex its muscles is the
Well, they're not going to be looking to make movies about the treatment of workers in Chinese factories, I imagine.
I can't imagine. No, that would be the Steve Jobs, the other side of the Steve Jobs movie that's coming out in the fall, I suppose.
Right. So it is an ethical dance, though, isn't it? Because if you were setting up a studio in Dubai, I would take issue with you because the treatment of people in Dubai, it's a country built on slave labor. It's been condemned by the international community. And certainly there are things wrong in every country. And China is a world power. So it's not the same place where you can affect change as easily. But should they be doing business there? Well, they are already. Can good come out of it? Sure. What do they have to worry about? They have to worry about the government interfering with what they do? Do they have to worry about investors overseas being upset that they're entangled with the government? You know, if China government has another crackdown, are they going to suddenly look stupid and bad for being in bed with them? You know, are these, you know, what do they decide in this when they do something like this?
Well, they will look as bad as, say, everybody that was dealing with South Africa during apartheid in the 80s.
But they weren't. They all got out.
They all got out. Right. So basically, that's exactly what would happen. And, you know,
and now they're going in.
Right. And they're
and
going
the question
in now
is,
because
China, South Africa.
No. Not necessarily. What I would say is part of the reason for going in is there's money there. There's money in...
Well, that's the reason for going in, isn't it?
There's money in films there, and it will be the largest, we've all said it, the largest, you know, movie box office in the world, if not
this. In a
week
or two.
Yeah. That said, there's only 34 films from the outside world, mostly the U.S., allowed in per year. So one way to get around that is to actually produce films in the country for the Chinese market, which is what Warner Brothers is doing here.
Will that make them eligible?
Yes,
obviously, that will be part of their goal. They'll have to say
yes.
These are local. Right.
I mean, it's in Mandarin. You know, these films will be in Mandarin, Chinese produced for China. I mean, yes, that's it's no longer.
I don't know. They got to get approved by the government. They could just say suddenly at the last second, oh, by the way, we're not going to count those as local, you know.
And that's part of the problem. That is part of the problem in dealing, doing business in a foreign country like China, where the rules are never really written down and they're kind of known, but not known. And they're kind of rock solid, but not really. And that's part of what Hollywood has been struggling with in dealing with China is that everything changes all the time. There is no normal.
That's right. So it's a smart business move. Do you want to make movies in the native language for the biggest market in the world? Yes, of course you do.
Yeah.
That means Mandarin. A week ago, that meant English. Now it means Mandarin. They don't travel as much as English language films do, I guess, perhaps. English is spoken in more parts of the world than Mandarin, I assume.
At least for now.
At least for now. That's right. But you have Tiananmen Square 2, suddenly that may not look like as smart a move. You know, that's a potential problem.
Well, and what I would say is the Chinese right now are saying, what do you mean about Tiananmen Square?
Never heard of it. Yeah, don't make a movie about it.
Yeah, I mean, right now, just today, they've arrested 200 people for spreading quote-unquote rumors about the stock market and other news events. And some of these people are journalists. And so, you know, you kind of have to be careful when you're doing deals.
Right, they want a stock market, but they don't want people reporting on it.
Right, precisely.
And they don't want people selling their stock or just, you know, saying the government's propping the stock up to keep the market up artificially. So you get in trouble.
Right, correct.
So I think they should make family films about cute little children and puppies.
Oh, I get it.
That would be safe.
But maybe they can get Tom Cruise to start.
That's right, I'm bringing it back to the puppies. So Warner Brothers going to China is a big deal. It's a smart deal, but it's a dangerous one.
Well, wait a second. If Warner Brothers going to China is a big deal, then you know what I'm thinking? It must be time for Big Deal or Big Whoop.
You're right.
Yeah. I mean, that's our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story, death the cable boxes, baby. The New York Times has declared a war on cable boxes. Most consumers rent them, of course, from cable companies and spend hundreds of dollars a year to do so. In a major editorial, the Times has called on the FCC to free up cable boxes the same way they freed up phones. People used to have to rent phones from AT&T at a huge expense until the FCC said, no more. That brought about a wave of innovation and cost savings. Now, the same may happen with cable boxes. The FCC may rule this week on the issue, allowing people to buy their own cheaper cable boxes and hook them up as easily as people buy a new unlocked cell phone and then hook it up to the service provider of their choice. Big deal or big whoop?
I thought it was a big deal, but now I guess it's a big whoop.
What? Why?
Well, because, you know, I was going to talk about, oh, you know, I hate how I would have a cable box and I'd want to replace it with a newer one that wouldn't let you do it. You had to get the same model that you had. So you were stuck with this old, you know, with a tiny little DVR, you know, storage. It was just annoying and so expensive. But when I looked at all the readers' comments on the New York Times, basically they were all like, you guys are so behind the times. They're like, what the hell do you need a cable box for? And they're talking about all the other things that they use and do. And others said, cable boxes are not the problem as such. It's competition. There's no competition. So this is a Band-Aid on the real problem, which is that all these cable companies have monopolies. So I think actually the readers of the New York Times really, you know, educated me and said, hey, yeah, you know what? This is really getting lost in little details when the big problem is over here. Or the big change is over there that we're not using cable anymore. I mean, they were, again and again, people were saying, yeah, I have an Apple TV and I use this and I have Netflix. Thank you very much.
Yeah. Well, and I think that right there, we talked about it last week, is part of the problem. And so
part problem?
Well, part of the problem for cable operators is that people right. are
I think TV is still valuable. The people who own the libraries and are creating content is great. But if you're a pure play cable provider, it's a tough time because this is going to nibble away at your bottom line yet again, because it will probably happen by the FCC. You're going to not be able to charge those monthly charges. And suddenly you're going to find out a big revenue stream has disappeared.
Well, and maybe what the FCC is thinking here is, or maybe the New York Times is thinking, is, hey, you know what? You may not be able to, you know, get rid of geographic monopolies overnight and just pull the cord on that. But, you know, why don't you chip away at it? First, get rid of the cable boxes. Get rid of the monopoly on that. And for, then, you know, choose some other, in other words, nibble around the edges, weakening
well, right,
the
yeah,
entire...
they're right on the issue. There's no question about that.
Right.
It just may be 15 years too late.
Well, that's true. Isn't it always when it comes
of course,
to cable?
Cable's in, what, 95 million homes? So,
yeah,
it's not that late.
Amazon is on the march. The company is launching Prime Instant Video in Japan next month and comes at no extra charge for members of Amazon Prime. Coincidentally, Netflix is launching in Japan this week.
What an amazing coincidence.
Imagine that. This comes on the heels of their miniseries Narcos, a look at the drug wars that marks a major push into the Latino and Hispanic communities. They plan on being available all over the world and want original programming to make that happen. Meanwhile, Netflix has doubled its Los Angeles office space in Hollywood, in fact, to 200,000 square feet. That's like the biggest real estate deal in Hollywood in eons. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big whoop, right? We know it's happening. It's just the latest step forward. It's what you expect. What I want to know is why hasn't Netflix bought a building? Why are they renting?
Well, because it's just cheaper to rent, actually. It's probably
in what world?
Well, because you can expand and retract at you know, easier. So I don't know why they're renting, but they are. And it costs a fortune to build in LA. So
do you know where it is?
It's in Hollywood at Bronson Studios.
Well, why does Netflix need to be in downtown LA anyway? It's Netflix, for God's sake. It can be in a warehouse on the edge.
It's not in downtown LA. Right now, they're in Beverly Hills.
That's crazy. That's a total waste of money. You don't have to have your offices. You're a digital company.
But they are dealing with, I mean, this is for all of the creative executives and
they're going
to lunch with the, you know.
Blah, blah, blah. Yeah.
Yeah. So, it's
you know, bragging rights.
Here is the big deal for me about this story. Okay. Mm-hmm. I'm an Amazon Prime subscriber. I'll admit it. Okay. I thought it was a big
waste. Is it a shameful?
I don't know. Maybe. Here's the deal. So Japanese yen, 3,900 yen per year. I thought, my God, that's a lot of yen. That's probably like $1 million. Yeah, no, it's $32.48.
That's what they pay for Prime for a year?
Yes. And here's what I would say. I pay like $90 for Prime. How come mine is $90 and theirs is $32.48?
It's the same reason you pay a lot more for your prescription pills.
Well, I think it's, you know, we're talking about getting shipping something on an island as opposed to, you know, shipping it across 6,000 miles of land. I think that's...
But the stuff, you know, they got to get it there first.
Yeah, that's true.
All right, moving on.
Moving on, we're gonna. You know what? Let's move from Netflix, which is I guess we were talking about Amazon Prime. So let's shift to Netflix, which is losing a valuable library when its deal with Epix lapses. They paid $1 billion to Epix for 5 years of access to films like The Hunger Games and Transformers just 90 days after those movies debuted on the Epix channel. You might remember we talked about this when that happened. You know, here on the show.
That's how long we've been here.
Yes. That library, by the way, that Epix library amounts to 1,000 plus movies And by the way, those are the few current blockbusters available at all on Netflix. Now those 5 years are up, and so is the deal. Epix has reportedly signed a new non-exclusive deal with Hulu. It's unclear whether Epix or Netflix walked away from renewing their agreement, though once the dollar amount of the new Hulu deal is out, I guess we'll be able to figure that out a little bit more. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big deal, I guess. It's a change for Netflix in a way. It's pretty clear now, I think, that Netflix walked away because they wanted exclusive. They were sharing it with Amazon. Amazon also had the rights to those movies from Epix, and they want exclusive. They're paying $200 million a year. They want exclusive rights. They want to be HBO. You know, they want to have stuff you can't get anywhere else. And Epix wants to be on as many platforms as possible. They want to be on Amazon and Hulu and anybody else that will pay them money. So, you know, I think it makes sense. You know, it makes sense for Netflix and it makes sense for Epix. I was thinking people were going to talk about the importance of TV to Netflix, that if you're going to invest money, you're better off buying television series with a lot more episodes because it gives people a lot more time to soak up a TV show as opposed to movies where they may not care for this movie at all. But if they like the show, they've got 3 seasons, 5 seasons, 8 seasons. Maybe that is where their viewership is more often. Maybe TV shows are more important than movies. But I don't know if that's the case.
I don't know either, but I can tell you that I'm really surprised sometimes at the movies that are not on Netflix.
Well, that's the other thing. You know, the harder it gets for people to find out where a TV show or a movie is, the less good it is. You know, when you don't know where to go to find something and you got to search it out, well, A, that opens up an opportunity for someone who wants to say, hey, you need to go to Netflix or Hulu or Amazon, you know. That's helpful. Maybe somebody can make a business that way. But it's just not good for consumers when they don't know where Seinfeld is or who has South Park reruns. I forget. You know, you have to remember it's Hulu. It's not easy.
A new song has just topped the charts in Austria. It's called 1 Minute of Silence and amounts to, well, just that. 1 Minute of Silence on the air.
Let's play it now.
Hey, you know what? Now I can remember all the lyrics the next time I do karaoke. The tune is intended to bring attention to the refugee crisis in Europe, where people fleeing war and desolation are seemingly dying by the hundreds every week in one disaster or another, the result of desperation and traffickers taking advantage of various unrest and turmoil around the world. Proceeds, of course, will go to aid refugees. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a big whoop, of course. It's a nice gesture, but I'm worried that they're going to get sued.
Why is that? Because
I think John Cage is going to sue them for, you know, stealing ideas from his song 433.
Oh, yes, that's right. He's going to say it sounds
like he sits at a piano and does nothing.
Yes,
they're ripping him off. He should have songwriting credits. He should be getting a piece of the royalties. Maybe he'll donate it to refugees as well, but that's his choice to make. So watch out, charity single. John Cage is coming for you.
And Marvin Gaye's estate has actually contacted Mr. Cage to...
said, by the way, you might want to get in on that.
Yeah. The Hugo Awards are a major institution along with the Nebula Awards for sci-fi and fantasy authors. The Hugos held their annual convention and handed out awards recently, or rather... they would have, but many of those awards went to... Hold on. The award...
Just open the envelope.
Yeah, the Hugo goes to... Oh, wait. It goes to nobody, actually. That was the decision of fans, at least, who fought back against the Hugos, becoming overly political. Disgruntled members who called themselves the... I can't believe this. Sad puppies. This is like the puppy
and
show.
And then they became the rabid puppies. Those were the even more ardent right-wingers.
Oh my gosh, they decided too many Hugos were going to what they see as writers awarded more for their race and gender rather than the most popular author. Needless to say, those fans are more conservative in their politics. To reclaim the Hugos, which are voted on by the fans, they push back against what they see as politicization. Say that 5 times fast. Instead,
politicization.
Fans and authors like George R.R. Martin said awards to women and authors tackling bold topics were actually a positive sign and well-earned. Battles have gone back and forth, but the result was that numerous key categories loaded with ballots went to nobody, no one, zip, nada, niet, as Michael likes to say. Meanwhile, the Hugo for Best Novel went to The Three-Body Problem, the first book from China to receive its top award, which means the debate is far from over. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, it's a big deal in the world of the Hugo Awards. And that book, The Three-Body Problem, it's supposed to be great. I haven't read it yet, but I have a friend who just started and he likes it. And it's by Xichen Liu. I'm sure I'm butchering that, but he's a very popular author in China, one of their best, certainly in the sci-fi category. So it's cool to see them shining a spotlight on him. And hopefully it means that the Hugos can just vote for who you think is the best rather than trying to make some statement. I don't think anybody in the last 5 years was saying, let's just give it to a Hispanic. You know, it doesn't work like that, hopefully. And I think the awards were going to well-reviewed authors. So I didn't see any like tokenism going on there. So I think the sad puppies were wrong. And hopefully they will give up and not just vote for who they like.
So the MTV Video Music Awards took place recently, last night, in fact. Kanye West got a Lifetime Achievement Award for interrupting acceptance. Oh, wait, no, I'm sorry.
He said as a video innovator.
I know. He said he'd be running for president in 2020, which I can only hope is a joke.
Taylor
Swift won Best Video and Best Person in Life, apparently. And host Miley Cyrus referred to Snoop Dogg as her real mammy, continued her feud with Nicki Minaj, and announced the surprise release of a new album available for free online.
Whoa!
Yes, while none of it was actually surprising, the VMAs are a TV special disguised as an award show, let's face it. Perhaps the least surprising aspect was Cyrus giving away a new album free online. Nowadays, really, the only surprise would be announcing a new album 6 months or a year in advance. And by the way, Adele, we're looking at you. Big deal or big whoop?
Well, we won't know if it's a big deal until we see the ratings, I guess. It did set a Twitter record. So there you go. And maybe that's what counts for them. But, you know, it's a TV show. Big whoop.
Do you love your TV?
I do.
Of course you do. It's widescreen.
I would marry my TV.
Yeah, it's widescreen. It's high def. But someday you'll want to replace it.
No.
Will that be with 4K? Probably not. Will it be with an 8K screen? Maybe, but not likely. Instead, 5 years from now, the hot new TVs will be in HDR. I agree, actually. That stands for High Dynamic Range, and the Consumer Electronics Association just set new voluntary standards companies should meet to deem their product HDR compatible. With standards set, manufacturers don't need to worry about which horse to bet on, like the battle between Betamax and VHS. And consumers can rest easy. Their TV won't become obsolete. Big deal or big whoop.
Well, it's a big deal, right?
No, it's not.
Oh, talk to me, baby. I thought, you know, we sort of say, why don't you just do this? But these things are hard and complicated. And in this industry, you got to worry about, you know, antitrust. And it's complicated. You got different competing manufacturers with different goals. And so setting a standard isn't as simple and direct as one would think, unless you're in China where you can just announce what the standard is. So I thought, oh, good. They've set a standard. It's pretty early. It's going to help, you know, unite everybody behind the right standards. And apparently I'm wrong.
Yeah, however, they actually, what the CEA did.
CES.
Well,
CEA, I'm sorry,
yeah,
CEA.
CEA, yeah, that's why when I said CES, I was like, I think I got that wrong. I think it's the Consumer Electronics Association, which, by the way, helps put on CES International, which is
that's why I got confused.
Yes, they basically approved the definition of high dynamic range. So basically what they're saying is we're all as manufacturers going to agree that when we talk about HDR, we are saying the following, and we're defining that TV as the following. However, it's not necessarily, it isn't a standard. Okay. So it's not saying here's how to build HDR television.
It's not helpful. It's just a meaningless gesture. Or why did they do it?
No, why they did it is because they are the Consumer Electronics Association, and they have to basically appease consumers who are thinking, well, I don't want to buy a TV now because I hear all these new things are going to come, and I want to make sure mine is compatible, and I don't want my TV to become obsolete. And so what the CEA is doing is saying, well, no, we as manufacturers have all agreed that this will be the definition of HDR. Now, how that gets built and how people build to that, who knows? We may not even be able to build to that standard. But
this is really early, right? People aren't buying HDR TVs yet.
No, because I think there's like one. It costs
$40,000. Right, yeah. This is looking to the future.
So really, when SMPTE, the Society of Motion Picture Television Engineers, and ISO, the International Standard Organization, when they actually set standards, then it's a standard. And then
this doesn't help. It's meaningless.
Says the manufacturers got together and said, look,
Be a standard.
Yeah, there should be a standard. And here's what we believe it should have in it.
Is it a step forward?
It's a step forward. The all of these standards organizations have been meeting about this anyway. This is a gesture to consumers to say, look, we know, we understand your concern, and we are working towards it.
And just like the leap from VHS to DVD and Blu-ray, or the leap from, you know, a nice TV to high def was a real significant leap and everyone could appreciate it, you say the same thing about us going from high def to HDR, don't you?
Yes, I think when you see HDR, yes, it's high def, but the colors are amazing. It's really, you kind of go, oh, I get, you notice the difference.
Whereas, and so you're gonna have HDR streaming?
HDR,
is that possible, or is there enough bandwidth now that you can do that?
I think HDR streaming is possible, but the bandwidth needs to catch up, and it will. Uh-huh. It definitely will, and the compression algorithms will catch up as well. I think, you know, when it comes to 4K and 8K, you know, a lot of people say, I can't see the difference. Yeah, and I think when you say, I love manufacturers' claims when they say, oh, you can't see the difference? Step closer to the set. It's like, yeah, but now my nose is touching the screen, so now what?
And will there be HDR disc, like Blu-ray in HDR, or is that contradictory to say that? Or
I don't necessarily know that there will be Blu-rays or any type of physical or optical media, because right now, the reason that we have that media is because it's the only way to get content from point A, the studio, and the content owner, to point B, to the consumer. If there's another way to do that via streaming or otherwise, or you
rent it. But it's a good way if I don't have a streaming connection, or I don't want to have to download 800 movies. That's just old school, isn't it? Thinking you have to have a physical copy.
Correct, yeah. And so if there's another way to do that, another way to distribute it, then absolutely they will find that way, especially if there's a way that is more renewable, where you don't just sell something once, you make people rent it every single month.
Yeah, yikes. Okay.
Now, one of France's best directors is coming to Hollywood. Jacques Audiard has delivered a string of impressive films in recent years, including The Beat That My Heart Skipped, Rust and Bone, and A Prophet. Now, after winning this year's Cannes Film Festival with Dupin, he's coming to America.
Mon Dieu!
Yeah, Audiard's English language debut will be that most Hollywood of genres, the Western. He's adapting the novel The Sisters Brothers by Patrick DeWitt, and John C. Reilly is set to star Big Deal or Big Whoop.
I can't help thinking it's a big deal. I know it's not really in the scheme of, you know, director gets movie. But, you know, I love Odiar. I think he's a terrific director. I'm looking forward to seeing Dupin. And I love this book. The Sisters Brothers is hilarious. It's a great Western. It's funny. It's violent. It's really good. Run out and read it now if you haven't. Or maybe you should read The Revenant first. That's the Western by Michael Punk, which Iñárritu has turned into a movie that's coming out at Christmas. But it's a great role for John C. Reilly. It's a terrific book. I'm so glad it's being made. And by Jacques Audiard, I'm fascinated. Can't wait to see it.
Someone should take away pitcher Kurt Schilling's social media accounts. That surely would be the advice of our friend, former Showbiz Sandbox co-host and social media expert Karen Woodward. Schilling keeps getting in trouble for shooting off his mouth online. He posted pro-Confederate flag comments, insisted the only reason he didn't get into the Hall of Fame was because he's a Republican, because let's face it, baseball is so liberal. And now he's at it again. Schilling tweeted a dim-witted post saying, and this is a quote, "It's said only 5-10% of Muslims are extremists. In 1940, only 7% of Germans were Nazis. How'd that go? The math is staggering when you get to true numbers," end quote. Actually, the stupidity is staggering when you don't know your history, but that's another story. ESPN suspended Schilling from his duties, though obviously that means he'll apologize and be back soon. The tweet, of course, was soon deleted. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big whoop, right? Because they don't care, nobody cares, and it's going to be forgotten next week. You know, they dumped him from coverage of the Little League World Series, and everyone was like, well, he's on Sunday Night Baseball, you know, what about that? And so the next day they're like, oh, yeah, he's off that this week too, this week. So clearly they're just hoping it's a tempest in a teapot. He's a buffoon and a moron, and they hope everybody will realize that and just go, oh, well, he's just an idiot. And next week he'll be back on Sunday Night Baseball and nobody will care. So, you know, it's not like the guy should be fired for being a moron, but that's who you're in bed with. You know, big surprise if he's going to make dumb statements.
Yeah, and I'm not going to even touch this, even though I have some comments about his statement there. I'm not going to touch it. Leave no stone unturned when it comes to marketing your movie. That's Disney's whole philosophy. Or in the case of the new Star Wars film, leave no box unopened. Yes, Disney is turning to YouTube for an event to publicize the toy launch of tie-ins to the next Star Wars films. It's taking place on YouTube, where Disney is launching an 18-hour marathon combining everything from trailers to videos of YouTube personalities unboxing toy merchandise sent to them of course, by Disney. It starts on September 3rd and climaxes on midnight of the 4th, the day fans can rush to Walmart, Target, and the like, and buy their own copy of all the new stuff that they saw unboxed. In a related item, George Lucas is shopping for another vault inside a mountain where he can store his ever-growing hoard of cash, although I don't know if he gets any of this money because Disney now owns the company. Big deal or big whoop.
Doesn't he still get money for merchandising? No.
I don't think so. I think, you know, you sell the company, you sell the rights. Done.
Oh, well, okay. I guess you're right. Well, it's a big whoop, right? It's a clever marketing move. You know, it won't work for everyone. It won't work forever. But, you know, right now it gets you a little attention, right?
Yeah, I heard this morning on Marketplace, the NPR radio show, and I'm sure it's, you know, public radio and whoever does Marketplace. Frederick Green, who is a movie trailer researcher, he said, you have teasers, you have featurettes, and you have a whole quote-unquote ecology of movie marketing materials. This is just another way in the ecology of the movie marketing, another tool that they're using.
Well, it's a Marketplace, by the way, is American Public Media. But I love someone had to curtain into like, well, you're only going to reach fans of unboxing videos and hardcore Star Wars people. It's like, well, duh.
Yeah.
What'd you think they thought that grandma was going to watch it?
What I love is that the article in the LA Times said, you know, that they, you know, everybody can go on September 4th when retailers are such as Walmart, Toys R Us and Target will open with shelves stocked full of Star Wars merchandise. Because their shelves aren't already stocked with Star Wars merchandise. They're already, you go into any of those stores and look around.
Oh, it's already out there?
Well, you know, in some form, maybe not for the new movie.
I think a lot of it will be coming out that day. That's the whole point.
Well, maybe the original Star Wars.
Yeah.
And then the people who are saying, well, you know, the good thing is that it's getting these kids, these unboxing things, getting these kids who didn't grow up with Star Wars, you know, excited about it and knowledge of the Star Wars. And I'm like, what? Because kids who didn't grow up with Star Wars also don't own DVD players? They've never seen Star... Who is this Chewbacca you speak of? no, they know exactly who these characters are.
All right.
All right. Well, Michael, who lives in a pineapple under the sea?
SpongeBob SquarePants.
Who is square-shaped and porous and yellow is he?
SpongeBob SquarePants.
That almost sounded like Yoda. Who's got his own musical?
SpongeBob?
That's right, SpongeBob the musical. Oh yes, the water-soaked hero is headed to Chicago with a new musical that premieres in 2016 and is eyeing Broadway for 2017. He'll have a string of all-stars on his team with new songs written by everyone from Cyndi Lauper to David Bowie. Tom Kitt of Next to Normal is overseeing the music and Tina Landau is directing. Is this a big deal or a big whoop?
I love SpongeBob, but I fear it's a big whoop because they should not be having songs written randomly by a bunch of different people. That's not how you create a Broadway musical. That's just the bad way. That's stupid. King Kong did that. Remember that musical in Australia? Oh, yeah. We're not watching that musical yet, are we? We're going to have big rock stars write songs for this musical because nobody gives a damn if David Bowie writes a song for this Broadway show. No one's going to buy a ticket because Bowie wrote a song. If Bowie wrote the whole score, great. But, you know, you've got to have a score with songs that drive the characters and move the plot forward. And you don't do that by committee and farming out tunes to this. It's just that is a stupid way to do it. It's never worked. Doesn't mean it can't work, of course, but it doesn't seem the smart way to go because SpongeBob is a great character. He's perfect for a musical. He's so enthusiastic. I can see it. But getting random rock people like the guy from Aerosmith, Steven Tyler, to write a song for this show, it's just that is not a good way. That's a good way to do a soundtrack for a movie. It is not the way to create a Broadway musical.
Well, then maybe it will be a big deal when it comes out and it's worse than Spider-Man. Turn off the dark.
Well, they had one, you know, at least U2 did the whole score. That was okay. They were trying something new. Didn't work out, but that, you know, they were there and involved. Having just random people who aren't going to be there to tweak lyrics or write a new song to make it fit a new scene, you know, that's just not a good idea.
Well, that wraps up Big Deal or Big Whoop for this week and moves us along into Inside Baseball, where we analyze...
I'm sorry, I don't have time for this. I have to watch Transparent. I have not catched up on Transparent. I haven't seen a single episode yet. It's nominated for Emmys. I've got to catch up on the show.
Well, catched up? Is that like, you know, what you put on your hamburger? Catched up? Okay. Inside Baseball is where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you.
I don't have time. I have to watch Transparent.
Okay, well...
And Rectify. And Justified. And...
All the Ides.
Yes.
Okay. Well, that's kind of what we're talking about this week, that there are too many TV shows. Mm-hmm. We talked about this last week, and there are just too many TV shows. Is good stuff getting lost in the shuffle? And what's next?
All right. I mean, that's what, you know, we talked about it when, what's his name?
John Landgraf of FX. He was saying, hey, look,
John Landgraf of FX says, yeah, you know what? There's too many damn shows.
Yeah.
And the New York Times picked up on it. They did a story about it, talking about the whole industry. And they quoted Michael Lombardo, the president of programming at HBO. He said, quote, I hear it all the time. People going, I can't commit to another show. I don't have the time to emotionally commit to another show. Please leave me alone. He said, I hear that and I'm aware of it and I get it. And the numbers back them up, don't they?
Well, yeah. And here's what, and I know you want to walk off in a different direction, but just one point that I've seen over the last couple of months. And that is during the Great Recession, everybody liked shows like Orange is the New Black and, you know, all these kind of like downer shows, Sons of Anarchy and Breaking Bad. And now I've noticed that people are saying, you know what, there's just nobody on that show I like, or there's just, you know, it's another downer. Yeah, exactly. That, now that the economy's coming back, everybody's like, you know what, I just can't keep going with that show. It's just
that's sort of backwards from historically. The idea was during the Depression, that's when you wanted the gold diggers of 1933, and you wanted musicals and comedies to let you forget about your misery.
Right.
So you're saying that today the shows reflected what was going on rather than take you away from it. So that's sort of a little flip from what has usually been expected.
But that said, you look at The Walking Dead, right? Which is like the biggest show.
Happy show.
Yeah, biggest show in basic cable history, which kind of like came, you know, launched to 5 million viewers in 2010. And then you have, there's so many shows that when I saw this headline, I was like, wait, don't they mean The Walking Dead? Okay, Fear the Walking Dead. Okay, it's a spinoff, right? Biggest premiere for a series in cable history.
Okay, now we're getting confused here. You're talking about what are pop culturally hitting with people right now. The story idea is, are there too many shows? And one argument against that is what you started to talk about. The fact there have been, of course, as always, lots of hits. Empire on Fox is one of the biggest broadcast hits in years. As we talked about, it grew in the ratings every single week of its initial season. That's unbelievable. The Walking Dead, it's the biggest show in basic cable history. Fear the Walking Dead, that had the biggest premiere in cable history, basic or paid, I believe. That just happened. Game of Thrones is HBO's biggest show in history. And online, who knows? We don't have numbers for Orange is the New Black and House of Cards and Transparent, but they're getting a lot of ink and they're getting a lot of attention, just like the low-rated but beloved Mad Men. So these shows are breaking out through the clutter. They are finding a big, wide audience in various ways, as far as we can tell. But of course, there are a lot of more shows behind them that don't get seen as much as they should, like The Americans or Rectify or name your own favorite show here. So the question is, are there too many shows?
Well, I think there are too many shows when you see a headline for Fear the Walking Dead and you think they must be talking about The Walking Dead. I think, you know,
well, they launched it successfully. People knew it was coming out. They knew the spinoff was happening.
And what I would argue,
it wasn't like people didn't know.
What I would argue is that show, The Walking Dead, is now up to 17.3 million viewers that watch it live.
That's
when aired.
Just like overnight, practically.
Yes. And so what I would say is a lot of people tuned in. 10 million, 10.1 same-day viewers. Okay, 10.1 million same-day viewers. I would argue that a lot of them tuned in thinking it was The Walking Dead.
No.
I'm kidding, of course. But what I mean is, like, you know, you got so many shows that they're spinoffs of spinoffs.
Well, but Walking Dead and Fear the Walking Dead are very similarly named. That's a little unusual. The fact is that in 2009, there were 211 scripted shows on broadcast and cable and perhaps online. That's a little different because, you know, what you count as scripted. 2014, 5 years later, there were 371 scripted shows. Now, this year, we predict in the 2015-16 season, there will be 400-plus scripted shows. Is there enough talent to go around? Certainly in sitcoms, it seems like there isn't.
Well, yeah. I mean, you know, not every sitcom works, that's for sure.
Well, not if any show works, but it seems much more dire in sitcom. We haven't had a big, broad breakout sitcom. We've had a lot of innovative, edgy, small sitcoms like Louie and arguably Veep, which I think would have worked on a big network.
And Silicon Valley.
And right, but we have not had a big, you know, juicy Modern Family type hit in quite a while. And I think that's because the talent is spread out too thin. So creatively, I think there's a problem. But just like he says, it's hard to get people to pay attention to your show. VH1 just canceled a show. They had renewed it for season two and they said, never mind. It's too hard to get an audience. We couldn't find an audience. We're not going to do a season two. You know, they say they've got a good show, but nobody's watching. It's hard to, if you don't break through right away, people aren't paying attention.
Well, and then you have HBO, which is kind of saying, you know, we did great with dramas. Look at Game of Thrones and and a lot of the, you know, what was it? Empire Boardwalk, Boardwalk Empire, or whatever.
Well, that wasn't a big hit, but that was, you know, they did it for 5 years. It must have been profitable for them.
Right. And now they're kind of going into what they have, the Russell Simmons project. They have John Oliver. Now they're going to have Sesame Street. So they're kind of doing like non-scripted drama. Or
yeah,
Langdorf
said, hey, I'm not Langdorf, but what's his name at HBO? It's Michael Lombardo. He said, you know, I'll do a drama if it's going to, you know, strikes me as something really bold and different. But basically, we're looking at other areas to distinguish ourselves. There's so many dramas out there. We don't want to just do a drama. You know, they always want, of course, a breakout drama. But he's saying, look, news thing and commentary like John Oliver, documentaries like The Jinx, that was a big success for them, that documentary film, Russell Simmons and what they're doing with him, family programming like Sesame. He's saying we've got to think outside of what we were doing before to sort of break through the clutter. We can't just do a drama and a comedy. It doesn't work as easily. And there are definitely a lot of good shows that are falling through the cracks. But I'd say there's a lot of good shows. That's a good problem to have, right? Maybe Rectify is not tearing it up the charts. Maybe The Americans isn't getting Emmy nominations. But people know them. People are finding them, and they'll be there forever. People can find them, you know, in the future. That's the problem, right?
What is the deal with The Americans? Why is nobody like...
Well, it's doing decently in the ratings. They keep renewing it, right? It's not a disaster.
No, and I love watching it when I get the chance, although I haven't in about a year, so.
Well, that's the problem, right? People say, I'll catch up in 3 years. You know, call me when your show's done. That's how I feel about, like, Louis and, frankly, Joyce Carol Oates. But she's a writer. That's a different story. But anyway, when there's so much out there, sometimes people say, well, if you missed the first 6 episodes, I'll just catch up after 5 years.
That's right.
And I'll do it in a week.
That's kind of what I did with Breaking Bad.
Oh, well, there you go. So why are there so many shows? For one thing, TV's year-round, isn't it?
Yeah, really now it is. Now it is.
Yeah. What else? Why? I mean, there's just more outlets, I guess, right?
Right. Well, there's, and of course, diversity, I would say. Don't you think? Right. You know,
well,
shows
yeah,
for different
diversity
people.
Because you're running out of ideas. You have to do shows about, you know, women of color in prison because you've done all the other ones.
Well, and I'd say that, like, when you have a 24-hour news network, you start making up the news because you have, like, 24 hours to fill. So there's, like, more hours, and more networks means more hours to fill.
Mm-hmm. And everybody wants original programming. Whether you're a network or a cable channel or a video game console or a website, you know that one thing you need is original content, original programming. It's not enough just to be AMC and rebroadcast great old movies. You want to be in the new movie show. You want to be in the new movie game, the new content game.
And when you're out of the new content, well, even if you're in the new content game, you still have, it's like an annuity because you kind of say, hey, you know what, Seinfeld? Let's put that on streaming. We can make some money with Seinfeld on streaming. And they do.
Right, they're valuable properties to have. And of course, like you say, older shows are more accessible than ever. So when you're trying to break through and there are 400 new scripted shows going on right now, meaning they're in their first season or their fifth season, but you've got 400 plus shows all creating new episodes this year, more than ever in history. But that's not it. You also have to compete with Seinfeld. It's not just reruns. It's VHS tapes, it's DVDs, it's streaming and on demand. I mean, The Wire is available forever.
Well, I can tell you that if you are still competing with VHS tapes, you may be in the wrong decade.
Right. But, you know, it may be hard to find out where an old show is, who's got Seinfeld, who's got South Park, but they're out there. So if you want to catch up on a great old TV show, you know, it used to be hard to find them. You know, that was, oh my God, a DVD collection was so exciting. And there are still a number of great shows that I love that are not available, like I'll Fly Away and St. Elsewhere and Buffalo Bill and Tattingers, you know. So that list is out there, but it is getting shorter. When I look at my favorite shows of all time, most of them are available one way or another.
Well, now let me ask you this. I'm a little off the subject as we leave Inside Baseball behind.
Okay.
But is Scream or Nightmare on Elm Street one of your favorite horror films of all time?
I'm not a horror movie buff.
Neither am I. However,
I'm really not. So, you know, I know Nightmare on Elm Street 4 was supposed to be the really great one. I know that this first Scream movie was kind of clever, toying with the tropes of horror movies.
Right.
And I know that Wes Craven's a pretty cool guy.
Well, he was a pretty cool guy. He died over the weekend at the age of 76.
Oh, God, what was it? Was it werewolves? Was it vampires? Was it zombies? Or did he just fall asleep?
I think he had the big C.
Oh, yes. I mean, if werewolves aren't scary enough, he had brain cancer, and that certainly is frightening as well. So our sympathies go out to his family. But what a great career he had, and just as doing well now as ever. You know, he has Scream on TV. He had another film project in the works. So even at 76, he was, you know, firing on all cylinders. So that's pretty great. And this is a guy who loved horror and did it his whole life.
Right.
He made porn so he could make horror. He was a porn director. He wrote and directed porn. And he's like, someday I'll get to make horror. People usually make horror so they can get out of that and do something else. But horror was where he lived.
Right. Actually, he lived next to Pauly Shore's house. Actually,
did he? Was he the neighbor, the last house on the left?
I don't know. He was the neighbor of a friend of mine, Wes Craven, that is, who rented Pauly Shore's house up in the Hollywood Hills. And Wes Craven was his neighbor.
Your neighbor rented Pauly Shore's house?
Yes.
Am I to assume that that's a pretty nice big house?
It's a nice house. Nice view. That's for sure.
There you go. Very good. I think you know more powerful people than me. Everybody lives down the street from you.
Well, I will say this. There were about 10 people living in that house. Well, it took 10 people to afford it.
Well, Wes Craven was not the only person to die this week. So did director Gary Keyes, didn't he?
Yeah, he is a documentarian, if I'm not mistaken.
That's right. I'm not really familiar with his career. He died at 81, and he started as a producer of pop and jazz concerts. He did jazz concerts at MoMA in New York City. And then he made a film about Dionne Warwick, one of the great stars. And then he was off to the races. He kept making films about jazz and pop and, you know, stuff. He did for CBS, he did a TV special. I love this. The original Rompin', Stompin', Hot and Heavy, Cool and Groovy All-Star Jazz Show. You couldn't get that on CBS today. But had Herbie Hancock and a bunch of jazz all-stars and was a hit. He was on PBS and especially Duke Ellington. He really documented the Duke. He made three different films about Duke Ellington over a 40-year span. So a great career, and I'm looking forward to checking out some of his work.
Well, and you maybe have checked out some of Oliver Sacks' work. And if that name sounds familiar, but you can't really place it, it's because Oliver Sacks really wasn't in the entertainment industry per se. He was a neurologist and an author. And, you know, they turned his a portion of his life into a movie called Awakenings.
An Oscar-nominated film by Penny Marshall.
That's right. I guess, what was it, that based on the man who mistook his wife for
No, that's based on the book Awakenings.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. No, so he's a science writer, a neurologist, a practicing neurologist. He died of cancer at 82. And I think it's really a testament to how wide-ranging his interests were and how good his writing was that you saw this covered in a lot of different specialized outlets. I mean, he's famous, so everybody would report it. But you'd see it in science magazines. You saw it in Hollywood Reporter and Variety, because a lot of his works were translated into films and documentaries. You saw it in, you know, geeky science area. I mean, he just was all over the place. Popular websites. I mean, Oliver Sacks really touched a lot of areas and a lot of lives in his work. So I think it's interesting and speaks to how compelling he was. You know, but like you mentioned, The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat. That's one of his first breakthrough books. It's a collection of case studies about people with strange disorders. They were struck by lightning. They had a metal pole go into their head. And suddenly somebody who never could play the piano could play the piano. You know, they were all, or suddenly was brilliant at math, or they saw numbers with colors attached to them. Like red, you know, the number 47 would look bluish gray. All these weird phenomena that he would write about. And as somebody said, it was a very nice description. They said, describing his patient's struggles and sometimes uncanny gifts, Dr. Sacks helped introduce syndromes like Tourette's or Asperger's to a general audience. But he illuminated their character as much as their condition. He humanized and demystified them. And I think that's what he's known for. And, you know, one of his last books was Hallucinations. And this was a book about how hallucinations are common throughout history and the different ways they occur. If you're blind, you might start to hallucinate visually. If you go deaf, your body will compensate and perhaps start to hallucinate audio hallucinations. Obviously, you can take drugs and hallucinate. And I actually found the book really helpful and meaningful as my dad was getting dementia and dying, because you were realizing that when he saw people in the closet standing there and was talking to them, or he would talk to people in the room that weren't there, it wasn't that he was going crazy as such. His brain was entertaining him, was giving him hallucinations, because that's what your brain does when certain things start to shut down. And so knowing it was common in nursing homes, knowing how he described it, sort of made it really a lot easier to deal with when it was exhibiting itself in my dad.
Oh, that's good to know. I didn't know that, actually. I know that one of his last books was on music and the brain.
Yes, he was very prolific, and he wasn't without controversy.
Yes.
His final book published was a memoir. It just came out. But, you know, some scientists dismissed him as a mere popularizer who added nothing to scientific knowledge. And one activist for people with, not disabilities, but people dealing with different conditions, said that Sacks exploited the people he examined professionally. And he called him the man who mistook his patients for a career.
Oh, wow. That's.
But I think you can, I don't think you want to downplay how important it is to popularize medical knowledge and how hard that is and how hard it is to write clearly and intelligently about medicine and science and all these issues. And I think I interviewed him once for a really bad movie based on one of his pieces. And, you know, he's a fascinating guy.
Well, was. And it's good, you know, we're helping popularize his work here.
That's right. You know, check out one of his books. Go see the chamber opera, The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat. Watch one of the movies, and you'll learn something.
And subscribe to our show in iTunes, the Microsoft Marketplace, or Stitcher. You can subscribe to our shows wherever they give podcasts away for free and rate and review the shows there. It does help us out. You can also write to us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. So along with reading Oliver Sacks' work, write to us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. Call us, 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. You can follow us on Twitter, @ShowbizSandbox is our handle, or you can like us on Facebook. It's facebook.com/ShowbizSandbox. All of that information can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's also where you can find links to all of the stories we've discussed on today's episode, showbizsandbox.com. So ways to subscribe to the show, follow us, contact us. showbizsandbox.com. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on MySpace, if MySpace still exists, or on their website, whoismgmt.com. Michael Giltz has a website, and every week it is something new and exciting. What is it this week, Michael?
JohnCageWasRobbed.com.
Ah, I see. And that is referring to a minute of silence, correct?
That's right.
Yes. Well, if you can't find any of Michael's work covering the entertainment industry there, try michaelgiltz.com, where he archives a lot of it, or you can head on over to the Huffington Post, or you can try looking at bookfilter.com. Some of my work can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.
'Now, Sperling, I would like to quote a passage from One Moment of Silence.
Do we have to wait the whole minute?
Is it a fair use problem?
Yeah.
We've got to stop. Use. Okay.